There's a town in England that had a wisdom foresight regarding our ecology crises. They foresaw 75 years ago the problems we're walking through today. And they had a town meeting to see what they could do to save their environment from being polluted. At the start of the meeting, instantly they recognized the single greatest threat they were facing would come from the combustion engine. And they banned it. They had no problem on that at all. From that day to this, nothing with a combustion engine has been allowed in the town. No car, no truck, no motorcycle, no van, no bus, nothing like that. Their problem was trying to decide on the means of communication, of transportation they'd use in the town, both for themselves and for their goods. And they weighed the pros and cons back and forth, and by a close vote at the end of the day, they settled on what they've used now for 75 years. They settled on the donkey. And because it's crucial to their whole economy, every single person must have their own donkey. If you're ever traveling in northern England and visit this town, even tourists can't drive through the town. But if you look carefully enough, you'll see that the most senior man in town has his own ass. So does the most senior lady. Young guys got their own asses, and young gals got their own asses. Now, because they need their asses so much for life in this town, people are pushing their ass and pushing their ass and pushing their ass. And if you push your ass too hard, your ass is going to break down on you. Now, you might think that's funny because you've never stopped to think of what life would be like without your own ass. Very quickly, all your problems back up on you. So they borrow somebody else's ass. Now, has anybody else's ass ever moved fast enough for you? So people in this town try to help it along. That leads to a lot of fights because people don't like to have their ass kicked by strangers. Crucial as it is to life, there's a lot of peddling ass in town. A young gal will come and she'll park her ass where it doesn't belong, and the local cop, purely in the line of duty, has to pinch it. Once a year, everybody parades their ass in public. Now, you've never maybe possibly made a real study of asses, but they are not all the same, and they go looking for the best-looking ass in town. Asses differ, politicians don't. The day of the contest, you find the local mayor kissing ass for votes. There's a specific Sunday event that underlies my telling you this whole story. On Sunday morning, on a particular Sunday, all the Catholics in town hauled their ass off to church. Right in the middle of the Mass, an earthquake struck the town. Well, everybody ran out of the church to save their ass. Makes sense. Except for the priest. He had parked his ass on the side of the church, and he noticed that those windows were broken by the earthquake, and he thought he'd be real smart and just jump through a window and land on his ass. What he didn't know is that's exactly where the main crevice of the earthquake was, and he fell in it by mistake, proving even a priest can't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. I like to start this meeting off very spiritual. I'm Larry Kowalski. I'm an alcoholic. I happen to be an alcoholic. And I got here, among other things, because I'm also a Catholic priest who couldn't tell his ass from my autograph. I don't dress it, and you don't see any title, and I don't spend any time on it, because I'm dealing on the level of my disease. I am a priest in good standing in the diocese, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. I'm no longer in Sterling. I have been moved in the past 2 months from three very small country parishes to one quite large, by our standard, city parish. But anyway, since we started so spiritual, standing on the same line of deep thinking, this quiet elderly woman all of a sudden didn't feel good. She went immediately to see a doctor, and she says, "Doctor, I don't feel right. Can you help me?" And he looked, and he couldn't believe it. He got tweezers, and he probed. He says, "Ma'am, did you know you had a rectal suppository in your ear?" She said, "Thank goodness." He said, "I just told you you had a rectal suppository in your ear." She said, "Now I know where my hearing aid is." So, So just in case you can't hear me too well, just shake your head. And look at somebody over there right away, helping you find your solution. This rather rich woman, definitely not a lady, and this rather poor lady were both in the post-recovery room. The rich lady had just had her second child, the poor lady her first. And the rich lady looks over very haughtily and she says, "This is my second child. After our first, my husband was so pleased, he ran right out and bought me a 4-carat diamond." The poor lady looked over and she sighed and she said, "That's nice. But that wasn't good enough. He went across the street and bought me a full-length mink coat. That's nice." Through a sonogram, we determined that this child was going to be a boy, and he's promised when I come home from the hospital, we go right out and he will buy me a powder blue brand new Mercedes. That's nice. Well, hasn't your husband done anything for you? As a matter of fact, he has. When we found out I was pregnant, he stopped eating lunch, and he saved all that money, and he sent me to finishing school to become a better mother for our child. Did they teach you anything in finishing school? Yeah, they taught me instead of saying, "Screw you," to say, "That's nice." Now, if when I'm finished, you haven't enjoyed my talk, that's nice. I was a Catholic priest when I hit my bottom, turned to help for some people in the town in Lawton, Oklahoma. At that particular time, I was a living atheist. I definitely didn't believe in God, and I didn't want there to be a God. I had stolen just about every single cent for 3 years in a row that was in the poor fund. And I didn't do it for alcohol. I ordered the church wine, and there was always 52 gallon of emergency supply, and that was not my alcohol of choice. So I would never had a fear for my supply. Didn't do it for pills. I'm an alcoholic. That's my drug of choice. But I have used counter and street drugs as a backup. But I had an independent, free, unlimited supply of pills. I did it to finance other things that were trying to take care of the same inner pain inside, basically sexual. But they don't make you saint of the year for stealing every cent out of a poor fund. I didn't want there to be a God. If there was, if I had a boat, there wouldn't be. I didn't surrender to God. I surrendered to two people who brought me to a group. I surrendered to that group. Through them, I surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And about 2 weeks sober, I woke up in a universe I never dreamt existed. I was at peace inside. Using the old transactional analysis term, I was okay on the deepest level of my being. There was still a lot of pain, depression, guilt, fear, but I was okay. And I never thought anybody ever had that at any time because I'd never had it in my life. That couldn't come from me, nor could it come from any human power because I had been seeing the single best psychiatrist I've ever heard anyone in our program ever visit for 6 months and just falling apart, hating myself worse inside. 5 years sober, I was in a different town, and I drove 140 miles to celebrate my fifth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was driving home, smoking 3 packs of cigarettes, and my dad was a coal miner. We've never had family money. I've never had a lot of money for a variety of reasons. For the first time in my life, I had good lighters, 2 excellent butane lighters, gifts from people for being clean, and I was looking forward to smoking. And at 11 o'clock at night on it would be May the 28th, 1978, I pulled a cigarette out, 77, and I heard God speak for the second time in my life. And what I heard was the words inside me, "You don't have to smoke now." I've never had a cigarette since. I went through no nicotine withdrawal. I was already working the program of Overeaters Anonymous, so I didn't put a pound of weight on, an ounce of weight on. I didn't have a pretzel or anything to fill it. And the single most exciting thing about all this to me is I don't smell smoke. To prove to you I have an alcoholic mind, about 4 months of just like I never smoked in my life, the thought occurred to me, well, if it's this easy to quit, why don't you just go back? You can quit again. Yeah. But I knew that if I picked a cigarette up, There would be smoke coming out of the coffin for however many years later it would be. I start out with this not in any way to convince anybody. As long as I didn't know inside me that there is a God, I argued. To me, even as a clergyman today, I will never argue whether there's a God or not. I have an experience, and I will share that experience. And I want you to know that I have this experience so that you'll understand the rest of what I'm going to share with you. Because I have this experience, I have come to know that I'm not an accident in nature. This is my view. That a loving God, it took me 2 years after I woke up with my peace to label this a God. It took me 2 years to label it with the God of any church. I wasn't in a hurry to do that because my religion hadn't been keeping me sober and giving me peace. And whatever this was, worked. And I allowed this to guide me. But I eventually came to see this power I had in my experience is personal. And my title for a personal power is God. I'm willed, therefore. I'm desired. I'm not an accident. And using some ideas I got from a set of very helpful to me tapes from a counselor in Arizona, Pia Melody, I believe my God intends me to be precious on every level of my being. Precious physically, emotionally, intellectually, sexually, socially, and spiritually. And I grew up without being able to be precious on any of those levels. As a child, when I showed two or three people already, I had ears that stuck out exactly this straight. People have heard me say this, and I think I exaggerate. And after being in the program for about 13 years, I finally found, no, it had to be 15 years, finally found and was able to look at a picture of me 7 years old. And the first person I showed it to in my home group said, looked up in total shock and said, "When did you have plastic surgery?" The typical reaction is people laugh. But you see, I went to school being called Dumbo and Big Ears. And it was said to hurt. My mother would use this too when she would blow up in anger to hurt me and my brother. And I blocked out my looks. Sober 12 years, when I would shave, I would see no face in the mirror. Sober 13 years, if I closed my eyes, I had never in my life been able to picture my face because I rejected what I saw. And when you feel to the core of your being that you're ugly physically, there's no way to become precious. There's just none within me. My mother has her own problems. But because of her problems in her life, I grew up not in any way thinking that my feelings are precious. At the age of 21, I stood at my dad's grave, feeling a tinge of guilt that I felt nothing, that he was being buried. I know today that I have, and I'll use the term codependent, and let me just give you my understanding. A codependent is someone who does not feel an inner sense of worth inside. And so they are. I am dependent on something, someone, some event, some achievement outside me to validate me, to make me feel okay right now. I had no inner sense of worth, and I wasn't allowed to feel my own feelings. I have never cried in my life. This past week, for the first time in a dream, I dreamt that I was crying. And it was very good. It had to be. And I was conscious of the whole thing, that I don't cry even in the dream. The man who was in my alcohol, my sobriety, what my own father never was in my own life. My father was gone all the time. Because my mother was such a strong, domineering woman, he just was never around. So I've never had a father. And this man was my father in AA. And he died recently, 31 years sober. And I performed an AA meeting as his funeral service. He wasn't Catholic in any form. But in my dream last week, I cried and cried and cried, and it was good. Because you see, I have only one tape playing in my head as far as this goes, and my mother saying with such hate, "You cry and I'll give you something to cry about." I not only can't cry, I don't even feel the luxury of feeling sorrow for myself. I have no right to feel anger. As a matter of fact, when you all were laughing last night at Ted's talk, I wasn't. Because, and I at times wished I could relax that much. Because you see, anything off the normal upset my mother. She didn't want us to be very happy as well as very sad. And so there's a total governor put on my feelings. And I want to just make a comment on this because I'm hearing things. I have not had a very pleasant weekend here because We hear all sorts of things about California AA back in Oklahoma. We're just regular alcoholics in Oklahoma. You know, we don't get upset if somebody mentions drugs. We don't center them or throw them out. And if somebody talks about problems from their home, it doesn't upset us. It's, you know, it just all happens. And I understand there are things that upset you. So I'm trying to say this. I want to share my own experience in a way that won't be offensive. I am not blaming my mother for anything. You know, it was a great insight for me to understand that I am different from you, and I'm not responsible for that. I didn't choose as a 2-year-old child not to feel, not to be able to cry, to swallow 52. I'm 53 years old, 50, probably 51 years of sorrow in here. I want to get it out. I've been praying for the gift of tears. I can't cry. I wish I could. I envy people who can. The difference is now, I understand the roots of my problem. I'm using the tools of AA, I'm using the tools of other things, and I'm going to a therapist because I want to be able to cry with my sponsor's full permission. I have an insight to what caused it, but I've got to live it, and I want to make the best of me. Now, I'm not blaming her, and blaming her wouldn't help me today. I want to walk through this, but it's important for me to show this. Anyway, it was impossible for me inside, not being able to have my feelings, to feel that any of my feelings were valid, were precious in any form. Unlike a lot of other people, a lot of alcoholics whose lives I've heard, and I've heard 500 to 1,000 fifth steps. That's no bragging. It's just a basis for me to know what we're like in many ways. My mind was not put down for thinking. Both of my parents had to quit school and had low-paying jobs, and they wanted us to develop our minds. My mind has always been valued for its thinking ability, but never for its doing ability. I could never do anything to please either of my parents. The only tape I get growing up in this area intellectually is, whatever I do must be perfect, and even then it's not good enough. So this affects a lot of things. I was just astounded. I was astounded 2 years ago after I started the therapy to discover in my entire life I have never tossed a basketball at a hoop. Because you see, it might miss. And you wouldn't know this, I've had nobody in my life to teach me how. Ever. For a variety of accidents, nobody's ever taught me how to throw a football. I've thrown a football twice in my life. Once as a young kid and it wobbled, and I knew a football wasn't supposed to wobble, so I never threw another one until I was sober. About like 8 years and tossed one, and it just sailed beautifully, too. I mean, just real as good as it could be. But you see, anything I do has to be perfect. Because, you know, just I don't belong. I'm not okay. And failures aren't all allowed. And all these, you know, these are strong rules in my life. Much stronger. I had no trouble stealing every cent in the poor fund. I'd be crushed watching you throw me throw a football that wobbled. I can't picture going to the yard and playing volleyball without having a private instructor teach me for 3 years first how to do it. It just boggles my mind. How do you become... And on top of this, around the age of 12, somewhere, I started getting suicidal thoughts. And nobody told me that they were thinking suicidally. So I thought I was different from every kid. And I thought my mind was different. And at the age of 14, I concluded... At the age of 14, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Didn't start drinking or drugging yet. At the age of 16, I concluded I would end my life permanently committed to a mental hospital. And I believe I would have if I hadn't found alcohol as my answer. But there was, I just thought suicidal, and I thought my mind just worked. I'm crazy. There's nothing precious about that. Getting good grades was precious, but nothing else about my mind was precious. Sexually, I have discovered that I was molested. I thought I was just molested passively. The incident I used to tell, and I'll start off with that. I came home somewhere, probably in junior high, and my mother stopped a card game, took me upstairs, threw the sheets off the bed, pointed to a stain I had on the sheets, and she said, "That's dirty, ugly, and sinful," with all the hate she could muster. And see, that's me, and that's not precious. That's dirty, ugly, and sinful. And that's a value that she has. It's a hang-up she has that she transmitted right from one generation to another, quoting Peel's phrase, "The beat goes on." Just from one generation to another. I tell this jokingly. If I go home now and she sees two flies on top of each other on a screen, she nearly goes crazy getting a fly swatter to kill them because they're doing ugly. That's her phrase. And see, that's me. That's part of what's in here. But even what I discovered worse than that is I was actively molested by her when she had my sister. And it's led to some very severe hang-ups I have in the area of sex. One of them being, as a clergyman, it is nearly impossible for me to visit the maternity ward. I'm not afraid of walking into a room and finding a woman naked. But a maternity ward is a different thing because there was something about a woman nursing. And what we've just touched on is, as a child, I was like two when my sister was born, I was jealous. And I wanted to be nursed. And my mother really shamed me. It was just a horrid, smothering experience. And you'd have to know her and the hate that would come down. And I've got some deep, locked-in feelings here. Now, if you feel that not just using sex, but the whole sex life is dirty, ugly, and sinful, and unfortunately the Polish nuns in the school where I went just built on all that feelings, there's no way to become precious. Just none at all. And I told you, I've already given you some hints. One of the sad things in my life is I've never fit anywhere. I grew up in a family where there was no room for me. Even physically, my parents had their own room, my sister had a room, I have a younger sister and an older brother. My brother and I shared a room, but it was his room. I changed clothes and slept there. I was a nomad in my own family. I went from room to room. Whatever room the rest weren't using was the room I could be in. Out in the backyard where my mother didn't let us in the neighborhood, it was my brother, my sister, and I. And being with him meant constant pain. And my choices were to be with others in pain or to crawl under a porch and live in a fantasy where there was no pain. And I opted for the no pain, and that's still my safest answer. Give me a rejection, I want to run right home, crawl in bed. Boy, I sure understood that. You know, just crawl in bed and just pull up and retreat from the world. There was nobody my age in the neighborhood, so I had nobody my age to hang around with. And this reinforced why I wouldn't throw the football or the baseball. My brother didn't teach me these things. My dad didn't learn. His parents were born in Europe, and he was, as a coal miner, earning money and out of the house so he wouldn't be around my mom. So nobody taught me how to do these things. I went to a Polish school. I wasn't picked last for sports. We didn't have organized sports. I wasn't picked when they played. They didn't want me, the guys. So I drifted off with the gals and felt like a sissy and hated myself for that and didn't fit in there. I've watched once the Charlie Schulz special. I mean, the Schulz special on Valentine's Day for Charlie Brown. That's the single most painful television program I've ever watched. Because I've gone to Valentine's days when I just didn't get a fraction of what anybody else got. See, I went to school in a ghetto, and I didn't live in the ghetto, a Polish ghetto. And they all knew each other, and they ran with each other, and I came from outside. People didn't dislike me. I just wasn't important enough to notice. And it's still the pattern of my life. You know, when I went through high school and made my own friends, I'm not exaggerating now. I called them 999 times for any one time any of them ever called me. 21 years a priest, I was a priest 15 years and no priest ever called me to say hi. It happens in the program. People just don't call me. It's just like I'm the overlooked person. I do have some good friends now where the calling is mutual. And I get upset when someone calls me. It's just like I'm waiting to hear the request. Because that's all my life. 45 years, I'd say. Nobody ever called to say, hi, Larry. And it just didn't happen. And socially, I didn't fit anywhere in the world. And how can you fit? I was dying to fit, to belong. And how can you belong? I tried other things. I don't have the time for that. None of them worked until I found alcohol. And alcohol was the answer for every single thing I've told you. I took a drink, and all of a sudden, physically, it was like a glow. My feelings were so strong, I never thought I was good looking. But it's like inside me a light went on, and you didn't see the ears. You just saw the light, and it was okay. And my feelings were okay. It was great to be exciting. I could be the life of a party and perform. And at the end of my drinking, the anger was coming out. And I, for a long time, that upset me. I was breaking up parties and things. I know today that was healthy. It was the only way I could get my anger out. Thank goodness the program has given me some tools to really handle this. So my feelings were okay. It was okay to feel. It was okay to be happy. My mind was okay. I thought I was really brilliant. Because you see, alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for the Al-Anons. And it took me a long time to hear that. I really had to listen. Ted gave that explosion. The explosion occurs to me. And like, it is my answer. Listening to some Al-Anons, and I've profited so much from Al-Anon. Everything I know that I think makes me a mature sponsor, I've learned from Al-Anons teaching real tough love. But listening to Al-Anons, a specific one, talk about handling a car accident helped me really see the big difference. She'd smashed a car, was real nervous, went home and had two drinks to kind of settle the accident. And I remembered my first bad accident. I sent out for a bottle because that was the answer. Other people use alcohol to solve problems, and they get something from it. But when I take a drink, that is the answer. I'm an alcoholic from the first drink. I didn't enjoy the taste till right here at the end. I persevered. Never upset by blackouts. I'm sober 18 years now. Honestly, I still want to slug somebody who takes a few sips from a drink and puts it down and walks away. That's alienation of affection. I mean, I'm telling you, I do not like that. And I don't understand it, I mean, in any form. It just does something for me. It was life. It was living. We had a black gal who spoke at our state convention in Oklahoma said what I'm trying to tell you. Alcohol is the answer to the disease of alcoholism. It certainly was for me. It rendered me okay, rendered me precious, and really enabled me to achieve. I got what I'm sharing with you was stolen from a few thoughts I heard Tom Iverson drop in Irving, Texas. If I hadn't drunk, it was like God made me with all these potentials, and I couldn't open them up because of the problems I've told you. And because of alcohol, I had the ability to flower, and I did flower. I'm a graduate of the Pennsylvania State University, very, very proud that I went there rather than to a seminary. I learned to think first and to appreciate thinking. And it was the drinking that I did that enabled me so much to get rid of enough pain so that I could be a good scholar. I went on and I started graduate school. I had 12 years of college, nearly straight A's. I could never have done that if alcohol wasn't in my life, and pills as a backup. I had the ability to meet people. I had the ability to talk with people. I didn't tell you how alcohol helped me socially. It really never fully made me feel good sexually. There was just too many hang-ups. I'm not saying I didn't act out sexually. I'm saying I could. The guilts were simply too strong in this area to feel precious. But when I took a drink, two beautiful things happened. It's like you were all just where you're at, and I'm here alone on an island. And when I'm afraid to leap to you, and you don't want me. It's not that you don't want me. You just don't want me. I take a drink, and it's like you all turn around and you open your arms, and there's a bridge from me to you. And that happened. The only group I know I was on the inside of, not on the outside of trying to belong, was the first group I drank with in a bar in Pennsylvania at the age of 16. I belonged to that group, and I know that. I was part of them, fully a part. And alcohol did that. It made me be precious. It enabled me to be social. It enabled me to talk to people. It enabled me to relate. It enabled me to confront. It enabled me to have romantic feelings. It enabled me in so many ways to be a full human. But I am an alcoholic, and the disease ran its course for me. I didn't mind alcohol getting out of control. That was no problem. I didn't mind the blackouts. They were just guilts I didn't have to remember. I didn't mind the shakes. You know, just the story I tell, I remember one Sunday I came down and had communion and my hand was a lethal weapon. At that time, we were still putting communion on the tongue, for those of you who would be familiar a little bit with our practices. And the way I shared, I couldn't have put that host in the Holland Tunnel. I didn't really discover the depth of this talent until I sobered up. But I have an amazingly honest-looking face, and I'm a good liar. And I walked up to the microphone and told him I'd just been hit by the flu. Would they get the pastor to finish the communion? Two things resulted from that. I got a lot of sympathy the next Sunday. I didn't deserve it, but I took it all. And secondly, from then on, and that was near the end of my drinking, on Sundays, I was so tranquilized on pills that if they had set an A-bomb off in town, I wasn't going to shave. See, I couldn't do it on booze on a Sunday morning. I couldn't be noticeably drunk, but I could be so sedated that I'd be almost the plant. And that's how I handled it. I didn't mind the loss of control. I didn't mind the blackouts. I didn't mind any of that stuff. What got me was when alcohol stopped working. And what happens then is alcohol had enabled me to develop my potential, and then all of a sudden, See, when it got out of control, it's like it froze the development, and then when alcohol stopped working, it's like all of a sudden it started pulling me back into the bowl. And so I ended up where I started, exactly where I started. The first sign of this was how I did my drinking. I did my drinking almost all out in public. I told you, it helped me be public. Then all of a sudden, I wasn't drinking in public, I was drinking at home. Then I was drinking at home upstairs in the second floor where my room was. Then I was drinking upstairs in the second floor where my room was with the door shut. And I was telling some gal that about 4 years ago, and she finished it because she had made the same journey and the shades down. And there had to be a television on and a book in my hand because I couldn't stand the only person that was in that room. I couldn't stand me. It was just real hell. I hated everything. You know, I drank. I couldn't stop drinking. I was out of control. I couldn't stop, and yet I felt uglier, dirtier, crazier, and lonelier drunk than I did sober. And that's the hell of alcoholism. Let me share this. I want to disagree with something, because I don't think it was said the way we need to hear it. As I understood last night, and I haven't listened to the tape, but I think we were told that the one thing on which we all agree is that when we take the first drink, we can't stop. Now, this book begs us to agree on something deeper, that we are equally powerless over the first drink. It's a different kind of powerlessness. But you see, I drank when I didn't want to. I started drinking again when I had every reason not to drink again. And I know in the depth of my being, I have no say as to whether I'm going to drink again. There has to be a power between me and that drink. That's the mental obsession. My mind's excellent, except where alcohol is concerned. And then it's absolutely just doesn't work at all. It doesn't bring from the past memories the way it would in every other area. So I have no control of whether I was going to drink again. But I get very sad listening around a table to somebody say if the program didn't work, they'd go back to drinking. And what makes me sad is that they have forgot, if they got there, what I just told you. You see, I've been where the program hasn't worked, or I haven't worked the program and felt it wasn't working. I was at a meeting 7 years sober on Thanksgiving, and I cursed the meeting because I said it's going to be a lot of gratitude crap, and the only thing in my life that could be worse is I could be drinking on top of all this pain. Because you see, alcohol stopped working, and it's not an answer again. And we were joking about this. In my 18 years, I have never heard anybody who's been in our fellowship for a year, two, three, four, or five, and they go back out, and they come back and they say, hey, you got it all wrong. You thought it stopped working? Give it a little bit of time, and it clicks in, and you get a second wind. No one has ever said that. Not one of them. And I guarantee the people I know, if that had ever happened, they would be here and they'd tell us about it. The ones I know clearly would. There's no second wind. The only thing I know from my past is alcohol stopped me working. It made me feel worse drunk than I was sober. So I don't have an answer. And I was in my room feeling terrible. Just, you know, the way I put it, I'll put it in nice English. At the end of my drinking, I would not have crossed the street to urinate on me if I were on fire to put me out. Okay? That's how I felt about myself. I'm here simply because, for whatever reason, I couldn't kill myself. I prayed. I didn't believe in God, but I prayed that some drunk would cross over on a turnpike and kill me in an accident. Now, what I need is to take everything that God intended for me to be and to start becoming precious. And that's what our program is designed to do, I feel. For most of us, it certainly did for me, it begins with the fellowship. And I was told to come late and leave early. This would be anathema in some areas of the country, some meetings, but it's the only way I could have come to the program. I came after the meeting started, and when people stood for the Lord's Prayer, I was gone. Because I was dying so much in here that it was impossible for me to look at you 5, 10, 15 minutes before a meeting and just sit there while you were just going on. I couldn't do it. I mean, I marvel at people who do it. I could not have sat. Because I was literally, and I've done work in a mental hospital, I was on the verge of starting to go catatonic even. Pull into myself, pull away from my body. And to go to a meeting and to have to come out of that and touch you was just too much. So I came late and left early, and somehow you communicated one of the greatest miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You communicated that we care, we share. That's the heartbeat of AA, the way it starts for me. We understand. And I've said this, and it's one of the things that I'm hurting about when I hear stories of how talks are being censored and people are being put down. You taught me the God that I preach now on Sundays in church, because it was not the God that I was under, that I thought existed. And it is the God that I can find in books. What basically I understand in most churches that happens is, I've just got to use example. I'm going to pick a guy so nobody can think I'm looking at a gal. But like if we had a woman who was a functioning prostitute sitting right here, most churches would say, you stop your prostitution and we'll be delighted to have you. Which means if you change, we'll accept you. Which really means we reject you as you are. And that they basically speak for a God that way. Now, I'm sure that every one of us here have prostituted ourselves. Every one of us have sold ourselves for peace, for sex. They've done it for money, for a roof, for drugs. I mean, I've done it, and I'm sure you have. And I've come to a deep understanding of what's wrong with prostitution. The God I have is a God who loves me. And what's wrong with prostitution is when I sell myself, I'm telling me that's what I'm worth. And that's the big lie of life, because I'm worth far more. Okay? I want to give you an example of this. You know, like if I tell somebody, you change and we'll accept you, I'm not part of her answer, I'm part of her problem. Him or her, I'm saying you're no good as you are, and that's exactly what I felt. That's why I could sell myself. Hell, if you gave me anything, I was getting more than I felt I was worth. I've done some retreats, and I've went on the 12th step, and a gal in another town listened to it. And I was visiting that town, and she asked to talk to me. And we got together. She was between 25 and 35 years old. I can't even guess a gal's age. Stunningly attractive by the world's values. And if anybody wants to put it that way, it's someone who grows up feeling physically ugly, because I really believe God doesn't make trash. Cultures have values. God doesn't. God just sees physical beauty at any size, at any shape. But anyway, she was stunningly beautiful, and she came over and she asked, one of the first things she almost did, she asked me if I would marry her. And I listened to the request, and I didn't react at all. And she said, well, if you won't marry me, can I put you up as a kept man? And I got to tell you, that still intrigues me. I mean, I do. There's just something. I had never thought about it. I mean, there's something there that sounds neat. Let me explain now. She was at that moment 6 months clean and sober and a functioning prostitute, and everyone in her group knew it, and I knew it. And she had been helped by my tapes, and she wanted to say thanks. And the only language she felt that she had to communicate to the world was sexual. And she wanted me to know, this is just not a handshake thanks. I want you to know the thanks. And that's why the marriage and the can I put you up. And I took them as the compliments they were. And her group, you know, took them as the compliments, everything she was doing. Within 6 months, she wasn't a functioning prostitute anymore. Because she had a sense of value. And either she had to lose the sense of value or constantly get more so she'd price herself out of business and into the universe and stuff, or, you know, lose it. And you know, she experienced her dignity. Well, that's what I got from you. That's how I woke up 2 weeks with you and knew I was okay in the depth of my being. Because you accepted me as I was. I came as far as I could with all the walls down. I came as a failure. And somehow, coming late, leaving early, you let me know that I was okay. There's much more to my being socially precious that I hope to share with you right at the end. There's one more, much more important things. The rest of the steps, I think, are also designed especially to help me feel that I'm precious, not so much physically, that came in a different way, but emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. I have to put everything in perspective. I can't make switching parishes. I can't make the possibility of having cancer the most important thing in my life if I'm to know who I am. Because you see, I watched two people die of cancer. One was a total turd. 3 years sober, people would see his car parked at one meeting house and they'd drive to another meeting house. They didn't want to be around him. And when he came down with cancer, he became one of the five greatest people in my life. From that moment on, for some reason, he was only concerned with the newcomer. And it was beautiful. I did his funeral. It was, I mean, it's like, well, both of these were such honors. I watched him about 2 months before he died in a wheelchair. He had had the colostomy and everything, sitting so shriveled, and there was a newcomer, and his lights would turn on. I mean, his eyes. And he picked the big book up, and I guess when you're literally dying, there's no waste. So he didn't have 11 chapters. And after hearing it so often, he was dead a year and a half, and I was talking about him. I finally checked my memory, and I was right. He'd pick this up, and if you were brand new today, he'd look at you, and he'd say, the first 7 chapters of this book, 103 pages, have the answer to every problem you have. And you could just hear one heart talking to another. He became great, and then I watched a woman I sponsor, after a third bout with cancer, drop all the people she sponsored, and I watched her shrivel. She lost the total experience of how precious she was. And Ray got it. And I know that whether I have cancer or not will not be the thing that determines whether I feel precious or not. It's whether I put my alcoholism and carrying the message and working with another human being that determines how precious I'm going to feel or not. And so, the first time, it was about a year and a half ago, I faced the possibility of having cancer for the first time in my life. I have a rare blood B negative, and I like to give it because they salivate when I walk in. They know me by name in the blood bank. And they turned me down for having iron poor blood. And then I took iron supplements and passed once, and then the next time they turned me down again, and I was still on the supplements. So I went up to my doctor, who was in the program. He sobered up a month before me. He has no tact at all. Genghis Khan was kind compared to him. And I tell him what I just told you, and this was his reaction. I don't trust their test, but if they're right, middle-aged man, iron poor blood, that means you got internal bleeding, that means you have cancer of the colon, and he walked away. Came back up about 2 minutes later, he says, oh, I don't trust those tests, so I went you off those pills for a week, and then we'll run some new tests. Well, of course, I had my funeral planned that night. But I had to remember, now I thought of these two people, and I had to remember, yeah, I may have it. And that was one of the two forms of cancer that, for a variety of other hang-ups, anal retentive and all that nice stuff, that I would least want to have, okay? But I had to remember from these two people that the most important thing is not any attitude toward cancer, but it's an attitude toward alcoholism and the fact that my serenity is based on my sharing with you, not my thinking of me. And I had a wonderful week. I had another little fear a year later and coasted on how well I did the first time and had a terrible week then because I was taking care of myself. I was pitying me the second time, and it was really bad. Second one, I have to believe right now, and this gets harder the longer I'm sober, that there is a power that will render me fully precious. And that's my second step. Not a power strong enough to keep me sober, but sane. And the word sane is from the Latin word sanus, and that's whole, healthy, entire. That I will be able to be the total Larry someday that my God wants me to be. When I was 12 years sober, I discovered that I don't know how to relate. I thought a relationship was coming up, and I've met Jim, and incidentally, Jim will be having he'll be 5 years sober on the 31st. He's celebrating it today because that's when his group does it, but he's a little hurt that he can never get the full claim at death, but... You know, we will honor you for having 4 years, 362 days today, I think it is. But no more, yes. We will not honor, I will not honor 5 years, because we can't guarantee, if we can guarantee it, we're saying somebody got power. So I've said it exactly, but, you know, the guy needs some kind of recognition sooner or later. But, you know, I could come up and like Jim, and then I go home to Sterling, where I used to be, and pull into my home, which was on a whole square block by itself, and live with the memory, and I called that a relationship. And I finally really realized I don't know how to relate. And it's so easy when you're 12 years sober, 40-some years old, to think I'm never going to learn how to relate. I'm never going to be precious in this area. And see, then that would put a crimp on my peace. My peace is dependent on my really believing that at some day in my existence, I will know in the fullness of who I am as Larry, how precious I am totally. And that translates to, I believe God's power is stronger than my weaknesses. And I study you and I listen to you. I have a friend who's a compulsive gambler, who's very important because he had a year and a half gamble free. I have a friend, sex addict. And he has 5 or 6 years in AA, NA, CODA, Al-Anon, but also in SAA, absolutely free of his compulsion. And that's important. And I see what Al-Anons can do for people who are with drinking alcoholics. And, I have a friend that I sponsor. Well, I've got more abstinence than she does, but I can look at hers easier than my own. Abstinence in the OA program. And, all of these give me experience of what a power my God has, how much greater it is than any of these individual problems. And then I can be patient. This is just not the time. And the third step says, in order for me to become precious on all these levels, I can't do it myself. I was honored once. One of my friends who had a tape of the month club selected a tape of mine as the tape of the month. And they didn't send it to me that month, and I wished he would, because I wanted to send it back with the phrase, listening to that son of a bitch is what got me to AA in the first place. See, I can think I got a brilliant mind, but I got me here. I mean, just as a total basket case. So I need someone else to tell me what to do. I'm in coat and tie. I've spoken at an NA conference. And in NA, tank top is formal dress. And I didn't even have a tattoo. I was depraved in that group. Okay? Because they all got those. And like Sunday morning, this is in Cheyenne, Wyoming, in the middle of July, and I'm standing up in coat and tie. Because my sponsor tells me anytime I know I'm to talk, I dignify the podium of any of these programs by dressing up. And if they didn't like it, that's their problem. Their approval didn't keep me sober. I was a popular preacher in my church because I was preaching me and using a lot of gimmicks right at the depth of my alcoholism. Most of the people in the parish liked me, but I couldn't listen to myself. I don't get my peace by pleasing them. I get my peace by my liking Larry and knowing my God loves Larry. And the tool to that is doing what my sponsor says. And it says dress up, I dress up. And that's how it occurs. If I'm going to have peace, I got to know. If I'm going to be precious, I got to know what size I am today. I'm 5'10 and a half. Supposing I thought I was 8 foot tall, and you watched me go through that door and duck all the way down so I wouldn't hit my head, you'd think I was nuts. Supposing I thought I was 4 foot tall, and I go into one of the little planes I get into to fly to Lawton, where you can't stand up, and I hit my head all the time because I think I'm 4 foot tall. Both of them make my peace impossible. I've got to know my size. I may not like it. I may wish I were 6 foot or 5'8". The only way peace can begin is when I know my size right now. And I just finished my inventory, and it was a very destructive thing. I began to see something that I've never seen. For years, I would tell my sponsor, I'm charging things to the church I shouldn't. And after about 2 or 3 years of this, he told me, you mean you're still stealing from the church? And I shared this. I honestly never saw those two sentences meant the same thing. And as I like to say, he has such a poor command of English. I want to teach him, the art of nice talk. When I left Sterling, the parishes I left them. The people loved me, but I left the parishes in a total mess. The churches are almost bankrupt. Not just from my charging things I shouldn't, but I spent too much money. And this inventory interlocked this with several other patterns that I have. And I began to really see my size, and it hurt like hell. I shared it first with the appointments had to go this way. I shared everything. I did the fourth step, as my sponsor told me. I happened to see my therapist first and shared the main area with her, and then everything with my sponsor, and then just with a priest friend. But anyway, I had a look at my size, and it hurt like hell. But that's the size I'm in some areas. See, I would like to be stronger and taller. I think I will live my own press notices and think with 18 years sober, I shouldn't have major areas of financial immaturity breaking out. But I've taken steps so that first it can't happen in my new parish. I appointed a financials. I went from microeconomics to macroeconomics, and boy, I could really waste money now. But I've got some dude who, he just doesn't bend at all, and he tells me when I can write a check for anything on the parish. He doesn't decide what we buy, but he says when we can buy it. And I'm taking steps so that these problems won't run my life. And it's a better thing, and I have to see my size before I can do that. In order to be precious now, I have to know who Larry is now. And then in order to be precious now, I have to have the freedom to become me, which means I had to share with my sponsor, with one person. Because you see, if I know who I am, but I'm making myself be who you want, I'm not going to have peace. A lot of people don't like, I know in a lot of conferences, speakers to have problems, speakers to walk with difficulties. I remember going to a meeting, and I was four years sober. And I was in a month of total depression, thinking suicidally the whole month. And we had a doctor who never wanted me to say this. He's drunk today, and I'm sober. That's very important for me to know. I owe it to you to say in a general way what I'm like. And I don't get my peace by saying what you want to hear. I get my peace by my being able to be 5'10", and in a general way, telling you I'm 5'10". And sharing with one person gives me the ability to do that. In order to be precious, I not only have to know who I am, I must have the freedom to be who I am. And I got that this Monday night when my sponsor came down, and he was falling asleep with his eyes just barely held up. That was good because I was at the sex park where I didn't want him to hear too much. It worked out just well. I'm happy. I was going to start with that. But happy I appeared. No, I'll take it the way he told me to write it. And so we got to that level. I don't know how much of it he heard or not. But anyway, you know, I now have the freedom to be me. The sixth step, I had brought this placemat up here. I'm going to do a show and tell. For years, this is what I thought the sixth step was. I was going to ask God to remove my dishonesty, financial. I'd ask God to remove my anger. I would ask God to remove my fear. I would ask God to remove my lust. Whatever. And this is what I would end up with. I don't have the ability to explain it all today, but I believe this is psychologically, spiritually, and biologically impossible. I believe there is something based in life that it never will want and can become less. It always needs to be more. And the sixth step has a radically different meaning for me. It is not my getting rid of. It's my becoming the full Larry, my being willing to be the total Larry that God would have me to be today. Do you know if I were filled totally with love, absolutely with love for me and love for you, I could never abuse you sexually? If I was filled so much with love that I knew how generous my God was, I could only be generous to you. I could never take from you. I can't get rid of a defect. God's love pushes it out. When I stopped smoking at that particular moment, I was filled with the love of God and thanking Him for the wonders He had been working for 5 years of sobriety. And I just was tuned in, and God took away the smoke, and it was a time to push it out. He doesn't rip out. He fills it up from the inside, and it just goes like it was never there. It's like I've never smoked in my life. Several of my friends watching, and I didn't even brag, I didn't talk about it, just try to quit smoking. And they all ran through a lot of problems because they ripped something out that they needed, and so another defect had to pop up in its place. So the sixth step is not my becoming less, it's becoming more. It's my being willing to let God fill me with love, with generosity, with kindness, with an understanding, with a patience, with all these things. And as that happens, I become more. The seventh step, what I share with you, is stolen from a friend of mine, from Surreal Local, the Surreal group that used to be my home group till I got transferred. It's a country group. The same eight of us met for 6 years in a row. We never had more than 19 people, rarely less than 10. We've had meetings of one or two. We knew each other. The guy who said this has wisdom without a lot of learning. He can't put two sentences together grammatically correct. But boy, he every so often, like every 3 or 4 months, he drops a diamond. And we were on the seventh step, and I was chairing the meeting, and we were going around. It was a discussion. We only had 2 minutes left when we got to him, and I apologized. And he said, "That's all I'm going to need," and he told this story. He said, "I have had one good molar left, and I love a good steak. And it wasn't feeling right. Now I'm going to put this in program terms." And I went to see a dentist. And the dentist looked in my mouth, and he says, "You have a defect of character. That molar needs to be removed." And he said, "I loved a good steak so much I was not entirely ready to have that dentist remove that defect of character." So I said, "No thanks," and went home. Unknown to me, I had an infection set in that molar, so that known to me, I could feel my heartbeat in my tooth. I was in the dentist's office the second it opened up, entirely ready to have him remove that defect. He opened my mouth, he looked in, and he says, you have an infection. He closed my mouth, handed me some pills, and he said, take these pills and come back in 3 days. 3 days later, my tooth was still hurting. I went back to the dentist, he opened my mouth, closed it again, and said, still infected, take these pills and come back in 3 days. 3 days later, the pain was gone. Now that's where my life and the story would separate. He went back to the dentist. The dentist opened his mouth and said, the infection's gone, and he pulled the tooth. That's the wisest thing I've ever heard on the seventh step. Why, when I'm entirely ready to have God remove something, doesn't he push it out? Because it's connected somehow to a spiritual and emotional and intellectual infection. And he knows right now it wouldn't be good for me to use this. I'd fall back on something worse. And so he says, take this meeting and come back in 3 days. Take this meeting, come back in 3 hours. And when God's ready, the defects just go. Just an astounding thing. If I want to grow in preciousness, I have to know that you're a person. I hurt because I go to so many meetings where people talk about 8 and 9 or 4 and 5 together. I'll share this also. I never, ever saw for 12 years, 13 years, how separate 4 and 5 are. They have nothing to do with each other. I don't think the arrangement of the steps in the big book makes sense. Chapter 5, I mean that. Chapter 5 deals with 1, 2, and 3, and 4. And then chapter 6 deals with 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. To me, it would be much more sensible for 5 to do 1, 2, 3, and for 6 to do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I mean, it's a logical separation. It's the way we talk about them in meetings. Bill wrote the fourth step. And if you want to astound yourself, if you ever hear somebody when you're on 4 talk about 5, beg them to read the big book. When the inventory is talked about, there is never a hint of ever sharing this with anybody. I take an inventory because I need to know what's not working in my life. The reason I'm bringing this up now is that most of the people, all the talk on 8 is on 9. One of the greatest revelation steps in the program was the 8th step. In our area, we sanctify a little bit more the 12 and 12 than the big book. It's just a historical thing. Nobody ever read the big book when I came in. One person used the 12 and 12. And this is just, so I'm more like from my own past, I know more about the 12 and 12. In the 12 and 12, Bill says you do a new 8-step list when you reach the 8th step. He said we got a partial list when we were doing our inventory. Now the time comes to redouble our efforts. And I believe that was necessary for me, that my mind had to settle a little bit. And when I hit the 8th step, what I did was I wrote people's names and what I did and why I probably did it. And when I was done, I was astounded. I had dealt with you as if you were a thing. If I thought it was good for you to be here, you should think it was good for you to be here. I never took into consideration the fact that you might have a feeling and be a person. And the 8th step is the step in which I learned you have feelings. And I have to work 1 through 7 as a sponsor quickly in my own way if I'm going to listen to somebody calling me and hear where they're at. I've hurt people badly trying to make suggestions for them because I wasn't listening to where they were at. And I would tell them to take a step that would give them an emotional or an intellectual hernia. I need to know where you're at, and it's the 8th step that tells me to do that. 9 helps set things right. Several of us have had the pleasure of hearing Paul Keebler. 10 is not a maintenance step. Paul's the one who helped me see. 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve. So he calls the 10, 11, and 12 improvement steps. And the purpose of the 10th step is for me to check on whether I'm improving, not maintaining. Because I believe, again, life can never maintain in nature. It's either growing or dying. And anything not growing is shrinking. And if I'm not improving, I'm shrinking. I can convince myself I'm maintaining, and I do that real well. 1 through 10, lie to myself. 1 through 10, empty the house. 1 through 10, help me know that my feelings are not ugly. 1 through 10, help me know that my thoughts are not ugly, but they can't make me feel precious. They can't fill the house. It's the 11th step that helps me know I'm precious. And the 11th step for me, my God is not truth. My God is love. And I don't know love in my mind. I know love in my heart. Now, I'm not arguing. Great spiritual people have God as truth. Others as God as love. So please don't hear any of this as a critique. My meditations are very different from yours. My meditations are designed to help me experience God loving me in my heart. They're very simple and very repetitive. I don't use any of the little books that are out. I use them sometimes for nice thoughts. But I will take the same story from anywhere and use it for months. Because as long as my mind is learning the story, my heart can't get the feel. I'll give two, three, the standard ones I've given for a long time and then a new one. The first one that helped me really see this was picture yourself as a 2.5-year-old child, badly afraid of thunderstorms, and there's a bad storm. And you come running and you jump in the arms of whatever loving authority figure you now have. And I'm not saying parent or, because so many of us have had abusive parents, molesting fathers, whatever loving authority figure, your sponsor or grandmother or a friend. Just jump in those arms and let those arms come around you and feel that love. That's my whole meditation. That's being loved. And that's what happened when I came here, because I had the emotional age of a 3-year-old and I was scared to hell of life. And there was a bad storm and I jumped in your arms and you put your arms around me and I felt it. The storm was still there and yet I was okay. That meditation changed my entire understanding of God, because it blossomed to this. Supposing you had a 2.5-year-old boy born with a warped leg. And you would just put him to bed. What would you have rubbed with the greatest tenderness and cried over with the warmest tears? You'd see how other kids would yell at him, laugh at him, and how he couldn't run freely with other kids, and that's what you would love. Up until then, I knew God loved me, but I thought from what I'd heard that God hated my defects. That day, I've known. For 53 years, my God has been crying with the greatest tenderness and rubbing with the warmest love my defects. Because he sees how others laugh at me for these. And he sees how they keep me from running freely with his children. My last meditation is me and the Lord at a restaurant, table for two, and the Lord just looks at me. Sometimes I feel love. That was easy, and I know my dignity. Once I felt total faith, my God has absolute faith that I can be Larry. And that really upset me. And then total confidence, hope. That's what the word hope means in religion. No wish, absolute confidence, because it's based on God. My God has total confidence because he made me, that Larry will be Larry. And then once in the meditation, and it's just, I just picture it, I just watched the Lord reach over and touch my hand. And that really hurt because, you see, he liked me. And I didn't want to be liked. That's the hardest of all. He likes me as Larry, as a full person. And that's all my meditations are. Now, the 12th step tells me how precious I am to God. I am who I am because somebody here needs it. I felt a lot of pressure, as I told you, because I'm not sure of your AA and different values and different views and rules. But I believe, and I got this from Don Pritz, who I'm so blessed I've had the privilege to consider a friend. And Don says when he's asked to talk anywhere, it's because one person here needs what I got to share. And that's the only person I have to talk to. And so I'm only talking to one of you. I wish I could give something to all of you, and if all of you get something, that's nice. But I believe I'm alive today because there's one person on earth that I'm special to carry the message for. And I believe when my work's done, this God that's loved me so much wants me to be surrounded by complete love. So I think, you know, I am here because I'm needed, and that's the ultimate value that I get being social. I told you, well, come into these. So socially, you told me I'm accepted. But it's the program that tells me you need me. And I'm priceless. I'm replaceless in God's plan. I'm going to close with this. It'll be it's from Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I heard a dude at a young people's at Whitney, Texas, when I was about 1.5 years sober. He was celebrating his second birthday. A cycler cried when he told this story. He read it. When Jonathan comes back, if you don't know, you younger people wouldn't know this, but he's a seagull who thinks, you know, you can really fly. You can soar higher than people are soaring. And he runs into a lot of flack from people who want to limit how fly. And he comes back, and he starts making some converts. And then all of a sudden, just one day, Maynard comes limping across the sand with a broken wing. And Jonathan looks over and he says, "What do you want?" And Maynard says, "I want to fly." And Jonathan says, "You can fly as high as you want to." And Maynard says, "You don't understand, I have a broken wing." Jonathan says, "You can fly as high as you want to." And Maynard starts flying. I couldn't even crawl when I came here, and I mean that. I spent 9 months as a turtle in a shell. Someone made me a statue, a ceramic statue, when I was 4 or 5 years sober, of a young baby turtle in diapers with a long neck. Because you see, I pulled into my shell. And that's a symbol of what the program was able to do for me. And I came to you and I said, I want to fly. You said, you can fly as high as you want to. You don't understand these problems. I can't cry. I got hang-ups from my mother. I got this, I got that. And our answer is that total faith, we know it. You can fly as high as you want to. Now, let me tell you how some of the ways I've flown. 12 years sober, I was at a conference in Jamestown, Jonesboro, Arkansas. And a very wonderful man sang the Lord's Prayer, and we all held hands to close a meeting. He wasn't doing it in a showy way or it couldn't work. All I did was picture my face. It had never happened. See, I cry for the gift of tears and I say not now. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, anyway, first you helped me know spiritually I was okay, and then emotionally, and then intellectually. And your love helped me embrace who I was physically. And I could picture my face. I didn't try to do it for a year and a half. I mean, once was enough. I'd have died happy then. But I tried it a second time, and I was astounded. It just came. Then I tried it a third time and a fourth time. Well, the one thing I really got to tell you about, I was in Irving with Tom Ivester, who happens to be my single favorite speaker, behind the podium and in front of the podium. He was talking, and I was in the front row, and about 20 feet in front of me, the table had ended, and there was a full-length mirror. And through his talk, I had trouble listening because I was flirting with myself. As Angie says, you can't get from where I started to there. There's no way. A nun taught me, so I felt precious physically. A nun taught me, and it took a year, 4 years sober, how to hug myself and not feel like I was putting my hands around garbage. And now I like to hug myself, and I feel me liking me, me loving me, and God behind it. I have some feelings. I can't cry yet. I can feel anger. I can act on anger. I have other feelings starting to bubble up. And I believe to the depth of my being that everything I am emotionally is precious. I don't need to act on it, but it's okay. I believe my mind is precious. I no longer think I'm going to end my life permanently committed to a mental hospital. I still do a lot of stupid things, but I'm still discovering how precious I am. I've discovered I have rights. The sexual area is still a major hang-up, but I still have rights. And one of the things that those of us who feel not okay find such trouble doing is learning to play. 9 years sober, I started learning to play. I went canoeing, and I felt guilty as hell because I was supposed to be doing something productive than just going down a river in Oklahoma. To show you the growth from that, I'll go back 2 years because it was the best. 2 years ago, well, 43 years old, this guy who won't try anything took some skiing lessons. Snow skiing, okay? I'm an addicted snow skier. I've done almost all the big resorts in Tahoe, been asked to talk twice in Stockton, and I went both in the winter, thank God. You know, just I go back at home and I say, boy, I tell them, been asked to talk in Stockton, which is just so close to Tahoe. Is there no limits to the length of sacrifice I'm willing to make for this program? Called up the priest in Tahoe, and priests are borrowed. We sponge. I stayed on him free. But anyway, two winters ago, I had 28 days of ski vacation, five trips. And I had the great blessing, and if, in case you're an Al-Anon or an ACA or a codependent, you may need to hear this. I don't take the Paris with me. I leave Sterling or Lawton, and I don't think about them unless somebody is in a severe crisis, and I may think about them twice and call ones because they need that affirmation. But I leave. It's there, and I'm here, and I'm in where I'm going to be, and I've learned to have fun. I'm not a black skier, but I can do any groom black. I do hard intermediates. I love it. Now, I used to ski very conservative because, see, my mother... Just, you don't try anything. I mean, her philosophy of life is behind every sun is a cloud hiding, save for the rainy day. Don't enjoy life because it's going to happen. And so, like, I never could be a kid. I didn't have it. About 5 or 6 years ago now, all of a sudden, I wasn't skiing on the conservative end of my skiing. I was skiing with a friend, a real good friend, one of my best friends. And we were just truly skiing, not just shooting straight down. We were passing everybody. This was at Keystone. And I figured, he's crazy going so fast. And it occurred to me I kept the same distance behind him all the way down the mountain. And now I'm pushing it. One of these times I'm going to come back to the parish in a body cast. But it'll be worth it because, see, I'm having the fun. The little 9-year-old boy who couldn't climb trees is climbing trees and speeding and doing all these things, and I'm having my fun where I don't risk anybody else's life. And I'm, you know, it's okay to be. I try new hobbies. I want to grow. You know, I want to be me. And that's what happened. I know I'm precious spiritually. I just know that. So putting it all together, you know, the message is, I know there's people hurting here. And Ted read that yesterday, that we insist on we're happy, joyous, and free. Remember what he also shared. Bill wrote this book, and then Bill wrote another book, and he had a 10-year depression. We hope, I really do, that you're happy, joyous, and free. Except for the fear of being here, I have the most peace I've ever had in my life. I'm facing some mature decisions. I've updated my inventory, and I always have great peace. I got success when I didn't want it. For years, I hated Oklahoma, and I got bad parishes. I got permission to leave Oklahoma. I chose to stay. I grew to the point where I don't have an ambition. You know, I don't even want to win an Emmy in my own field. The only thing that's important for me... The only thing that's important for me today, this was the last day of State of Growth. I went through midlife crisis, and this is what helped me do it. The only thing that's important for me is to be Larry. That's my only ambition. I want to be the fullest Larry I can be. And when I had no ambitions and didn't want a big parish, I got dumped with possibly our best parish in the diocese. You know, and it just happened that backwards way. So with all that, if you're hurting here, I understand hurting. I wanted to kill myself fairly recently when I screwed up the first parish before I did my inventory. The suicidal thoughts came. I've had months of not liking myself. We understand that, and there are tools. So if you think you're limping and that's as high as you can go, you know, I want to tell you, you can fly. You can fly as high as you want to.